and welcome to Diary 101 Podcast. I am your host, Akakande Bakandepoe, also known as Aka. I was about to say new year, new me, but that's an odd joke at this point. I am grateful to have this person on the podcast because, again, I feel like a lot of people that come on the podcast, it's a lot of rescheduling and scheduling. But then I'm grateful because I got to meet him way before and we had like a meeting and we catched up and we aligned. And when I kind of look at some of the things I admire about this person is I have a lot of questions because they kind of are amplifying some of the things I would like to learn or where I'm at as a person. And yeah, also kind of lives in the country of one of my favorite people in the world, which are my friends. So yeah, that's an inside joke now. It wasn't even funny. But anyway, with that being said, today's guest is Hassan. Hi, Hassan.
Hello, Aka. Thank you so much for such a generous introduction. I think you've overstated my contributions and my abilities a bit, but thank you so much for that, right? My name is Malak Hassan. Yeah. So my name is Malak Hassan Khan, right? And if I were to kind of describe myself, I would say I'm very curious about how the world works, right? So I'm very sciencey. I'm like a science nerd. You can ask me any science question and I'm going to go deep down into it, right? Apart from that, I do a lot of reading, I do a lot of video games, and I'm currently transitioning my career from sales and BD towards more data analytics, more science, computer science, and all of that. So at the intersection of business, computer science, and mathematics, there's data analytics, and that's where I want my next stop to be.
That's so interesting. I kind of had like an interview with the scientist, and it didn't go as planned. But it's so good to have a science nerd. But also, I have to mention, that was like not an over... How can I put this? So you live in a country that my friends live in. And they're my favorite people in the world. So you're from Pakistan and my friends are Pakistanis. Pakistanians? Yeah. And they're like one of my favorite people in the world. I did not know this before we had our meeting earlier. So yeah. So that's why I'm such a fan.
Yeah, like Pakistan is such a massive country, right? If you think in terms of percentage wise, right, this is a huge chunk of the world population lives in Pakistan. Yet a lot of people outside of Pakistan don't know about what Pakistan is apart from the news that you see on the media, right? So Pakistan is a lot more, a lot of other potential it has to offer, a lot of other stories in the streets, in the towns, in the cities, in the valleys that it has to offer to other people around the world.
What's your favorite thing about living in Pakistan?
Yeah, okay. So I think my favorite thing, and you'll hear this answer quite a few times, I think it is food. The food here is insane. I'm not messing with you, right? So I have a couple of my friends who went abroad to the US, to the UK, even to the Gulf countries and all of that, right? And even they say that KFC does not taste the same outside of Pakistan. Because in Pakistan, it's spiced everything. So everything is extra flavorful.
Yeah, so my friends also complained about the food in America. They can't. Like, oh my goodness. And I also have to say, KFC doesn't taste the same anywhere. Like, KFC in Zambia is different from South Africa, from America. So, yeah. I don't think the KFC in America, but yeah.
Yep.
So apart from the food, your Pakistan is full of culture, and I know the food is part of the experience.
Yeah.
If you could add anything to it, what would it be?
If I could add anything to Pakistan?
Yeah, no, to describe Pakistan apart from the food.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so I think there's a lot of history here in Pakistan and we kind of sometimes underestimate how much of history. Let me give you an example. So right in my backyard, like where I live in Swat. It's a valley in Pakistan in the northern areas of Pakistan, right? And right next to my house, I'm not even kidding, 5 minute walk away, there's a Buddhist stupa, right? Buddhist stupa is like a very religious site and it's 2400 years old. So it's like it was created in like 400 BC, and it was a very holy Bodhisattva site, and it still holds today, and you can still visit, come and visit it today. So it still holds. There's a lot of history here, a lot of culture here. And since Pakistan has been part of a number of different civilizations, the entire Indus River civilization, all of that, right? There's a lot of civilization. There's been a lot of conquests here as well, a lot of rulers here as well. So Pakistan has seen a very mix of like cultures and influences that has directly impacted how people think about this place, how people envision and experience the architecture, the food, the art, the science. All of that has been influenced by all of these factors.
I like that. What influenced your curious, what made you curious?
I think I'm curious by nature. So I don't think it's like things that had to do with me being in Pakistan. I feel like if I were in another country as well, even if I was in your country, I would be curious as well, right? That, right? So I don't think it has nothing to do with Pakistan as such.
So when you look back as a child, have you always been curious? And what are some of the things you did to spark that curiosity in you?
Yeah, I think curiosity in me comes from, and I think that is a major factor, right? So when growing up, my house did not have like a neighborhood, right? So it was surrounded by a marketplace, or like a market. So there was not like houses near to my house. So whatever friends I had were my cousins that were living in my house, right? And outside of that, I had no friends, etc. So when you're kind of living in that isolated environment, right, you tend to develop an aptitude for curiosity because you spend a lot of your time just thinking about things, right? Because if you're not getting that outside influence, you have to find it inside. And that's where I think the curiosity in me sparked. And from a very young age, I used to watch a lot of National Geographic, a lot of Discovery Channel. So that's where I think the science attitude comes as well.
I find that very interesting. I also think that I also grew up, I do have neighbors. I'm actually home. I was about to say I did grow up with a lot of cousins, but also we had neighbors. But as the youngest, I found myself isolated because no one really liked me because I was nosy and needy. So yeah, that made me wonder a little bit more and kind of want to know like what's going on, what can I try out, how best can I get into trouble and people not find out, that type of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
When you introduced yourself, you talked about a transition that you're experiencing now in terms of your career.
Yes.
How did you get that decision?
Okay. So before I made this decision, I was part of the partnerships team at Merham. Merham is a health tech platform in Pakistan that offers virtual and online consultations to patients, right? So as a patient, you can come and book consultations through an app and you can go to the doctor and show them that you have a consultation and they will check you out. So that's the kind of the basic core premise of what Merham does in Pakistan. So over there, I was in the partnerships team where we had to manage a lot of corporate partnerships. So if there is like anything related to a pharmaceutical company working with Merham or a hospital working with Merham or a clinic working with Merham, I was kind of the forefront person for that. I was kind of leading that. So that's where I was at before I made the decision. And why the reason I made the decision? So I was at Merham for like 9 months and the growth was kind of insane. I did a lot of sales. I did a lot of calls. I did a lot of meetings, pitch decks, and all of those things, right? But at one point, I just realized that maybe sales may not be the job for me, right? Sales requires a certain type of person. And I just felt that that person was not me. For me, things make sense when they are more logical, right? So, for example, if you're running an SQL query, right? SQL tells you when you're wrong. And I need that feedback. I'm like, okay, I'm wrong. I'm going to try this and maybe I'm right, right? In sales, you don't get that feedback. You might be doing things that might be right, that might be wrong. It's you just constantly iterating. That just did not fit well with my analytical slash creative mind, right? So that's when I made the decision. And I think this decision was ingrained way before I even joined Merham. When I was a university student, I usually enjoyed classes that were more technical, that were more programming focused, for example, RStudio or C++ or Python or even advanced Excel. So all of those classes were, I think, more fun than to me than, you know, generic marketing classes or communication classes and all of those things. So I think that's where my decision came. And I think the pathway for me was always that I was going to break into data analytics. And I was like, oh, this is the perfect time. And so I took a month off from my job and then I quit the job and I finished the Google Data Analytics certificate. So it's a specialization of 8 courses that takes you through all of data analytics. So I completed that and I'm practicing SQL, doing my portfolio projects and applying to new jobs. And hopefully that's where I'm going to end up.
That's a lot.
That's a lot, yeah.
I have to admit, that's a lot. And I do not know if I'm that analytical. Like, and that's a thing, right? I love how you've broken it down and explained why you are transitioning. And it's good that you know yourself to say, okay, great, I have been doing this for a while. And maybe it served its purpose by me just not, but it's time for me to move on, which I really love.
Yeah.
But apart from that, what did you learn working at Merham?
Yeah, okay. So at Merham, since I was learning sales and BD and all of those stuff, so for me, what was important was how do you close clients, right? And for that, I was reading a book called $100 million Leads and $100 Million Clients. Those are books by Alex Hormozi. He's a good sales guy. You can find his videos online. You can find his LinkedIn online. So I read a lot of books during my time at Merham, right? And I found that if you really want to close deals, if I were to sell something to someone right now, for example, if I were to sell this podcast to a company and tell them to sponsor this, I would go and tell them and show them if they even need a podcast, right? So I think if you want to sell something, you have to have very genuine conversations with people, not very salesy that we're doing a podcast, buy it. Tell them, ask them if they even need a podcast. If they don't sell it to them. They're not your audience, right? So I think that's one thing. That's one really important lesson that I learned at Merham. And I think the ability to sell is a very important skill that anyone should know. Anyone in any field should know how to sell something. So I'm really glad I had that experience. And I feel that sales experience is valuable regardless of where you are.
You mentioned one of my favorites. I love to read. any opportunity for me to talk about books, I can take it. I like Alex because of how he breaks down stuff. And well, I think now he has over 10 years of experience in selling. And their company is growing.
Yep.
What other book are you reading?
Okay, so so currently 2 months ago, like I was not a very avid reader. I have a lot of books. I just did not read them, right? Because I could not find the time and excuses and blah, blah, blah. But 2 months ago, I made a drastic change. I bought a Kindle. And ever since then, I've been reading like crazy. Currently, I'm reading Fahrenheit 451 on the fiction side. On the non-fiction side, I'm reading a couple of productivity books. There's one book about negotiation. There's a book on Scrum, how to do things faster. Right? I don't exactly know the names. If I can find my Kindle, I can tell you those. Right? But there's another book called Improv. Improv is about articulating your ideas and having communication. There's another book on user interviews, and the name is user interviews, right? And it's about how you can get useful insights from people you are interviewing for your parts, right? For your market research and all of that. So those are the kind of books I'm currently reading right now. But mostly I'm reading two books mainly. One is Fahrenheit 451. And the other book is Bill Bryson, Short History of Nearly Everything. So it's a book about science. As I said, I'm a science nerd.
I knew you were going to say, You're going to say that at the end. I was literally waiting for it. You mentioned something I like when you're talking about the book is you started with a fictional book. I am such a, I love my non-fictional books, of course. I read them more. I am such a fictional nerd. I think that my imagination grows better with reading fiction and just everything to do with fiction. And we never... A lot of people don't like coming out and saying I love fiction. And I don't know why, because I think that's what you need. Like, if I'm reading a productivity book in the morning, I'm reading Rich Dad Poor Dad. I'm rereading Rich Dad Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki. I can't read that book. I can't read a productivity book in the night, but I can definitely read a fictional book because that's what my soul probably needs to sleep.
Okay. So, my take on this would be right. So, a couple of years ago, I was off the same table. Like, I was like that maybe fiction books are a waste of time, right? You're reading stories that you don't even remember 2-3 days later. What's the point of reading fiction books, right? But now that I've read a lot more and kind of enjoyed reading as well, I think my perspective has changed. It has shifted 180 degrees, right? So what I feel right now is nonfiction can only take you to a certain point, right? So at the end, nonfiction is like a sentence of facts, a book of facts, right? It's not going to take you very far. It's not going to change how you think about the world. It's not going to expand your creative freedom, your creative gears, right? All of that, it's not going to do that for you. The next step comes with fiction books. Fiction books unlock like certain pathways in your brain that makes you connect, build more subtle connections between things that nonfiction can't really help you build, right? So when you're reading fiction books along with nonfiction books, then you're kind of taking full advantage of book reading, right? Because the kind of mentality you get from the fiction books, you can apply to nonfiction books, and it will help you actually help you retain your formation from the nonfiction books better and help you better creative thinking, critical thinking, and analytical thinking as well. So that's kind of my take on that.
And I also think that, like you mentioned, the fictional books build your curiosity, right? Because it's a story and you do not know how it will play out. Unlike the nonfiction, I can have an idea of what might happen. But what I've realized about the fictional side of stories is I'm not really sure what's going to happen. So the more you read, the more you grow your imagination. Yes. And the more you grow your imagination, the more you can actually let your mind wander. And how that helps with reading your non-fictional books or your productivity books is you can actually think beyond what you're reading. It's like, okay, great, I'm reading Rich Dad Poor Dad. If I don't agree with this statement, what else can I read? What else does this mean? So I think the fictional side of everything builds your imagination. For you to think.
Definitely.
And the nonfiction is meant to ground you and give you certain principles to navigate whatever you're doing.
Yeah, definitely agree with you.
One thing I've realized about you is you've been calling this for a while. You've been calling yourself a science nerd. Why?
Science nerd, why? Okay, so as I said, I'm actually very curious about things, right? I don't take things on face value, right? When it comes to science, for example, we all know about that electron has negative charges, right? Or that maybe Earth has a magnetic field, right? We both know these things. Everyone is taught in like fourth grade, fifth grade, you know electrons, you know protons. But then I asked, like a couple of months ago, I was like really thinking about it. I was like, why does an electron has a negative charge? Where does the charge come from? And the short answer is science doesn't know yet, right? At this point, we don't know what gives an electron a negative charge, because the current literature is that maybe charge is something that is like a fundamental property of an electron, like a fundamental property of the universe. You cannot break it down. Nothing is carrying it. Nothing is giving it. So that's that, right? There's a lot of subtleties in the universe, and I love to explore all of them. I love to explore all of these mysteries as well, right? So for example, if you think about an atom is mostly empty space, right? We are made of mostly empty spaces, and yet we can interact with things, we can see things, right? And maybe there's actually, if you go into like the quantum world, right, those vacuums are not actually empty. They're filled with particles, they're filled with elementary particles, they're filled with gluons and all of those stuff as well. So there's a lot of science going on as well. So I just love to wonder about these things, right? Why does thunderstorms rage on, right? Why do they happen? Where does the wind come from? Why is the wind sometimes cold? Why is it hot sometimes? Why is it fast sometimes? Why is it not fast sometimes? So those are things that like pique my curiosity, and it has been happening since my childhood, and even though I'm grown up now, it's still happening right now as well.
How is the tech sector in Pakistan when it comes to enabling your growth and learning more about data?
Okay, so the tech sector in Pakistan is pretty good, I would say. There's still a lot of place to be had, because if you look at the tech economy in Pakistan, right, the freelance Pakistan is like one of the biggest freelancing economies in Pakistan, and most of that is in tech, right? Software development, we have computer engineers as well, we have AI engineers, we have ML machine learning engineers in Pakistan, right? And they are contributing to technology across the world. But still, Pakistan, I would say, at its core, is not a tech country. And the reason for that is because we don't have the hardware to push those people to the limits, right? Pakistan does not have like a supercomputer, maybe a couple of them, but not a lot of them, right? Pakistan does not have, like, if you are in Pakistan, you do not have easy access to the highest quality of technology. You cannot get a Mac Pro with the most bested out version of specifications, right? And that's kind of where you kind of lag behind, because if you, on one hand, you have the best machine learning engineers in the world, and the other hand, you're not giving them the best technology to train those machine learning models on, then you are essentially already behind in the race, and they have put a limit to how far you can go. So, right? So that's kind of a limitation of the tech sector in Pakistan. The other question was like, how is it enabling my growth in data analytics? Yeah. So for that, I would say that technology is still not as advanced in Pakistan as it is in the outside world, right? So a lot of companies in Pakistan still use Excel as their main source of analytics or data storing, etc. And they're not going into the other side of the world where there's like machine learning, where there's AI, where people are using Python and Python libraries to get more advanced analytics, more advanced statistics. Those kind of technologies still lacking in Pakistan. So a number of companies that I can work in that can help me leverage all of the skills that I've learned till now are very little, are very niche. So that's kind of a limitation here in Pakistan as well. So that's why I'm kind of taking my time, looking for the best opportunity. I'm also open to exploring opportunities across the globe, maybe even remote opportunities. So yeah, that's that.
That's so interesting, because I listened to you speak and I'm thinking about the tech economy in Zambia, because I see us come up with very niche, very creative businesses that have to do with tech. And I've actually been having these conversations with my mentors to say, hey, the tech economy is actually very slow. And don't fail fast. It means I'm lagging and I'm not growing. And it's taking for me long to take responses or things I should work on. And I think that's a conversation we as a country are not talking about, to say, hey, this economy is slow. What do we need to do to create? And I love how you've kind of broke it down for everybody listening to just say, hey, sometimes you might have the best But if you do not have these equipments and this environment, it's kind of hard for you to excel, even if you have the best people working on it.
I'd like to just expand on that. I'm sorry I'm cutting you off. But expanding on it, Pakistan's neighbor is India, right? And if you look at India on a global level, right, you find that their tech ecosystem is completely on another level as compared to Pakistan. Google has their headquarters. Google has an office in India, a lot of offices in India, actually. Amazon has an offices in India. Microsoft has offices in India. IBM has a massive office in India. Apple is manufacturing iPhones in India. So across the border, a couple of 100 miles from me, the landscape completely changes. So I think it's like the governmental policies that can help change this, right? Then we have economical policies that can change it, how economical it is for you, for the country to procure laptops, equipments, internet infrastructure, all of those things. So I think it's going to take time. It's going to be a slow growth. But until then, we're stuck in kind of a limited scenario.
I actually want you to touch more base on what it means when you have companies like Amazon, Apple, Google have offices in your country, because we don't have, like, completely, we do not have any offices. So Google has no office in Zambia. Amazon has no office in Zambia. Like, what type of impact does that have on your tech economy when you have unicorn companies like those be in your country?
Yeah. So if you have like a company like Google here in Pakistan, right? Google, if Google came to Pakistan, it's a signal to other people, other tech players as well, right? That Google has seen something in Pakistan. That's why they're moving here. So on kind of like an off corporate scale, that's the signal that the market is getting. The Google's interest in Pakistan, there is something in Pakistan, right? That Google sees, and they are more confident coming in here. First thing that. Second thing is the infrastructure that these companies build, right? If Google is coming to Pakistan, they're not working on the botched or faulty infrastructures that the companies have, right? They're going to build their own infrastructures. They're going to build their own technology that will support their own growth. And as they are doing that, they're kind of uplifting the entire tech ecosystem around them as well, right? For example, if Amazon came to India, Amazon entry to India made like a gateway to e-commerce for India as well, right? So Amazon was like the first initial players that came to India. They made ways for companies like Flipkart to exist, made companies like those Swiggy and Zomato, those like quick commerce companies that delivered things in like 10 minutes. So if companies like Amazon don't come in, they don't test out the market, they don't have build those infrastructures to execute deliveries of like massive scales, you know, thousands of deliveries every single day. If that infrastructure is not built out, you are kind of lagging behind, right? For example, if I also give an example of Pakistan, right? So Pakistan, maybe our, you know, logistic industry was not as developed as it should be, because there's no like Amazon, there's no like eBay, nothing of those that sort existed here. But a couple of years ago, like a couple of years ago, right? Then a company came, Daraz. Daraz is like a Pakistani company that's now owned by Alibaba. So Daraz came, and Daraz started like mass e-commerce selling to company to like worldwide, right? That really helped build like the logistic infrastructure in Pakistan. And that logistic infrastructure is not only utilized by e-commerce, it's also utilized by every other industry in every other sector in Pakistan, right? So first, if you were not delivering to Swat because there did not exist like a solid infrastructure, now you are. Now you have laptops that come in other parts of the country, but you are delivering it to Swat because that infrastructure has been built out by Daraz. So those are like two ways in which these companies really help local economies to develop and flourish.
I like the breakdown because maybe it's something that I have been trying to figure out for my company, right? Something I realized, and I think this is where we're meeting each other. When I say we're not meeting each other, I mean Zambia and Pakistan is. I do not know about Pakistan, but in Zambia, we do not have a lot of data centers. right? So if I want information on a specific thing, or I want to start a consulting company, I will only get generic information, but nothing specific to Zambia, right? So that shows that we do not even have such a imprint on the internet that if I want to start an accounting firm, they're going to give me the big five. And they're going to give me the strategies the big fives are using. And I will not find anything on what a local accounting firm is using in Zambia. That's exactly, one. So, and you also touched down about when these unicorn companies or big companies like Google come into, it does signal something to other players to say, hey, I see something in this economy. Come try it out. And if the other players come try it out, it means they're pumping in money and they're now building the economy. So it, now it kind of makes sense to why it's not growing, or it's not a fast economy, because we actually do not have the bigger players in that economy. So even if as a small player, I'm trying to get into this economy, it's hard enough already because no big player has already done the foundation.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And that's why I am with my business right now, because I do know it's working. I'm testing it out and I have worked out, but I've reached a point where I'm like, okay, I do not have the money to do this. And I don't think the government will step in because this is not a priority for them. How are other economies actually surviving and growing in this sector? Because if I stay longer in this economy, I might not grow as a person and as a business.
Yeah, that's true.
Those are my thoughts on your thoughts.
Okay. So I think we can reframe your question better. So I think your question is that, like, for example, if the economy is not doing well, the government is not pumping any money, how do you kind of build your company in that sort of environment, right? Is that your question?
It wasn't a question, it's a thought, but I'd like, now that you've reframed it, it could be a question and you could answer it. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. So I feel like, if you kind of look at a company's, the way I think about it, right? I'm no economist. I don't know about those formulas, right? But the way I think about it, a country's GDP directly influences how big of a company you can be, right? If you are, for example, the US, you have $1.8 trillion or however, how much it is for them, right? Their GDP is in trillion of dollars, and Pakistan is just about $380 billion, right? So in the US, companies can scale to billions of dollars, even trillions of dollars, because their GDP allows that scalability, that ceiling for them, right? In our country, Zambia, maybe I'm not sure what the GDP value is for Zambia, but in Pakistan it's $380 billion, right? For companies in Pakistan, it's harder to grow and explode, right? You will see in the economy, companies are raising like $5 million or $1 million in like very, very, very small amounts. In the US, if a company is like raising funds, even in pre-series round or series A rounds, it's like $50 million, $100 million, $300 million. And they're like insane amounts of capital being raised there in the US. And that's because the local economy is kind of like supporting it. And it's pointing the room for that company to expand economically. So those are kind of my thoughts on that.
So if you could hypothetically give me advice on what do you, on me switching economies, to say if I get a chance to switch to the US economy or the South African economy. So the South African economy is actually doing better because it actually has these big players, or the Nigerian or Kenyan economy. Do you think I should take it? Because then that economy can actually house the type of growth I want.
But then there's also other factors as well, right? It's not just economy. Because I'm not sure what your product is. It's an online product. It's a tangible physical product. So I'm not sure about that, right? And then you also have to look at the populations as well. if your target audience is in the demographics of that country, or if another country, right, in the US, for example, in South Africa, their buying behaviors are going to be completely different. So you have to look at that as well. So it's not easy breaking into other economies, but hypothetically, you do break into one of these bigger economies, that can definitely accelerate your growth.
Thank you for that hypothetical answer. I actually love this because it really is bringing it home to what I have been thinking about and I'm working towards. Mm. So if you could solve a global challenge with data, what challenge would that be?
Okay, so if I were to solve a global challenge with data, that would be probably healthcare access. And I'll tell you why, right? So if you look in Pakistan, right, there's actually a huge chunk of Pakistan, a rural Pakistan, that does not have access to any medical facilities. I don't know the numbers, I'm not in the government, but if I were to guess, I would say around 50 to 40% of Pakistan does not have access to credible, well-maintained healthcare sources, right? And I want to understand why. Is it like the problem is at the government end? Is it the infrastructure costs that are rising? Is it the economy? What's the problem that we are facing, right? And we can expand this problem to a global level as well, right? Because if you look at Zambia, if you look at African countries as well, if you even look at Asian countries, even in China, even in developed countries, right? You don't have healthcare infrastructure everywhere, especially in countries that are more like islandic, like Maldives, for example, or you have Indonesia, which is composed of like 1,000 islands, right? So in those countries, healthcare accessibility becomes a challenge. And I want to understand how we can help solve this problem with the least amount, with the least cost, with the least amount of money, benefiting the most amount of people. That's kind of like my goal.
I like that. And I do think like healthcare is a major challenge. And sometimes it might look like it's only, let's say, the bigger economies that actually have this challenge. But even with a country like Zambia, I really don't like our healthcare system. Like, if there's something that will piss me off on a normal day, would be a hospital errand because of some of the systems that are playing into play. I don't have the same doctor. I have to be very particular about everything and ask questions actively because no one is actually paying attention. So that's like my pain with the healthcare in Zambia. And also, but I kind of am mitigating that to try to stick to one hospital where I can. But you know, I think like healthcare would be something I would, when I get successful or really rich, it's something I'd also like to get into just to learn what actually goes on and how best could we give access to healthcare to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Healthcare, good healthcare.
Hmm.
So Malak, I want to give you an opportunity to ask me a question.
Right. Yeah, so I'm actually very interested in knowing about your exchange programs, right? How do you arrange them? How do you find them? How is your experience like in different countries? And how does that experience help you grow as an individual in Zambia?
My exchange programs. So I've always been a curious person growing up. And yeah, I feel like I was always an underdog, not very book smart. So I really couldn't. I really might be good at communicating, but I'm not really good at writing and these other stuff. So I had to learn how to mitigate that. So I realized over the years, me being able to kind of mitigate a few stuff that I thought were weaknesses as strengths somewhere else. And I got picked for like the SUSE program. I think we talked about it briefly when I said that's how I got to meet and have friends in Pakistan, because we all went for the SUSE program and it was sponsored by the US. The experience is very different because you go to a different country, and I think that was my first time on a plane. You go to a different country that has a way different way of life. Like when I always come back home from traveling, I'm like, damn, I'm back in Zambia. But America was like, hi, guys, I really can't believe what I see on the TV is what I'm seeing. Not in terms of people, like the people are different, obviously, but like just the buildings, the access to different stuff, how wireless the economy is, how you can get whatever you want. You can just order it and it's flawless or seamless. And that changed how I looked at life, because then you start to compare to say, this is actually not easy in my country. This is not the access we have, but then it could be better. And I think I mentioned that I like to read, right?
Yeah.
I like to read, and I think I read about DC in New York. And I got to go to DC. I got to walk in the streets of DC. I got to play in the rain in DC. And I'm like, hey, guys, I actually read a book about being in DC when I was, what, 15? And at 23, I was in DC. So for me, it's like, oh, my dream came true. And that was just like the starting point. So I've done a little bit more travel, and mostly it's also the people. So the memories keep coming and going. You can travel, but then you get to meet really amazing people. And then you have a shared memory, and whatever you come up with, it could be a new goal, a new business. You always have people you can go back to and say, you remember I told you about this idea and this is where I'm at. And I might not want advice or not, but I want you to listen to me. So I think for me, it's the fact that I did make some of my dreams come true. I went to Europe this year. We went to Czech Republic, and I got to meet some of my friends in Czech. And that was also a dream. The fact that I did not know about, I always wanted to go to Paris, but hey, the fact that I was just able to go to Europe and go to Czech, and it was such a beautiful city. We went to Prague. It was such a busy, beautiful city. It just made my imagination come true. And so I think that I'm always grateful for that. It's exposed me to certain things that I would have never been exposed to. I always come back different. And it shows that I'm meant to really experience life fully. And every time you have access to certain things like that, you get to realize to say, hey, I hope somebody else from my country has access to that. Because then it changes how you think about life and where you're at and who you have access to, and also grows your network, right? Like you now have friends everywhere. So it means you have information of certain things from everywhere and access. So yes, I think, I don't know if I've answered your question, but for me, it's always been a dream to travel. So some places were never planned, but I'm glad I did. And yeah, I think that's why I'm traveling locally more as well, because I'm just like, hey, I'd like to experience my country. Because when you go to a different country, you do everything. You go to the museum, you meet new people, you're curious about everything. And I'm like, well, there's a lot to learn about Zambia. And before I relocate to a different country in a few months, I would like to just experience the culture too, so that I have something to talk about when I go back home.
Yeah, okay. So you made traveling sound so easy. I just want to understand, how do you kind of like navigate visa challenges? Because I assume those are challenges for you as well.
You're saying, how do I get to navigate what?
Visa challenges.
Visa challenges. So most of the things I go for are paid for, right? So it means if you are going, I'll use a practical example, and I don't, because I did do American programs, we are sponsored by them. And what that means is you have letters saying, hey, these people are coming for and everything is paid for. They're not going to get stuck. They're well taken care of. And because it's the Department of State doing it, so it's a different government agency, it's easier when they are taking you there and bringing you back than if I just want to pop up and say, hey, I want to go to America right now. There's all these questions you have to answer, especially now. So it just differs. It's like if you're doing it with your own money, they really want to know that you're not going to stay in their country anywhere. So yeah, for me, it was easier because for every trip I went for, it was paid for.
Okay,
and
awesome.
All I had to do was just show up and have a good attitude. But also, again, I have to say, like, you have to get picked to get into these programs. Then when you're picked to get into these programs, it's easy to have access to different stuff because you're now part of a bigger community.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense. All of these make sense. So, okay, you still make it sound so easy, right? I'll give you an example, right? So 2 years ago, I was selected for an Isaac kind of a volunteer program in Poland, right? So what it was like a 2-month program. It was called Happy Bus, right? So the idea was that volunteers are going to get on a bus and they're going to travel around Poland and on that bus, and they're going to like help students who are like out of school because it was like summertime in their summer break and kind of engage them in activities and make them help them have fun because students don't actually like little children don't get that accessibility or don't get that opportunity to have fun when school is off, right? So that was the idea of it. I applied for it. I got selected for it. It was completely sponsored. I only had to pay for like travel, etc. And when I was applying for visa, like you said that you had a sponsor, you had like a letter. I had a letter as well. I had 2 letters from the embassy of Pakistan in Poland. I had one from them. I had one from Isaac telling them that they are kind of hosting me in Poland, etc., all of that. But you show the letter when you go to the appointment and you meet the people, right, for the interview. You show them the letter and they're like, okay, yeah, makes sense. My appointment was 8 months after the program was supposed to end, right? So my program is in like June, July, there for which I had to go. And the visa appointment I was getting was post-October, right? So it was like impossible for me to go to Poland. And there was nothing I could do about it.
Wow.
Yeah. See, as I said, you're making it seem so easy.
I would not say it's so easy, but it was seamless. And maybe because even the traction, maybe a lot of people are not traveling from Zambia. I'm starting to think so. But
maybe, yeah.
Yeah, maybe that. Yeah, I would say that, but I would say going to the US was actually the easiest I ever did because it was automatic. They just asked a few questions and we left our passports and we later got our passports. Like that was easy because it was them, right? I think the hardest one was going to Czech because it didn't matter that it was being sponsored by the US government. It did not matter. They had so many questions. We had back and forth. We still had to take a few more documentation. So I do not know why. It could be embassy issues on your end when it comes to Poland. But yeah, again, I do make it sound so easy, but the Czech trip was like the most stressful one. I was ready to give up.
Yeah, that like
worth it.
It's not embassy. It might be embassy issues as well, right?
Because yeah, they're kind of embassy issues.
They are looking at visa They have visa interviews for only 2 days in a week, right? In like a 5-day week, they only do interviews for like 2 days, and that's only like 2-3 hours. So don't have a lot of slots open. And then when you have a country that's like a 280 million people, and most of them are going to Europe, most of them are going to Poland, so you're obviously going to have visa issues.
Yes. So maybe, like you mentioned, it's just could be an embassy issue.
Yeah. But like I said, there's nothing I can do about it. Like, what am I supposed to do about that?
I know, right? And US, oh my goodness, that was wrong. You were supposed to go to Poland. We would have been having a Poland conversation now.
Exactly. Things could have been different. And that's not it. So like I was going to Turkey and that was like 2021. And Turkey, we don't even have these issues, right? Everything was sponsored. Everything was covered for. I just had to get like the ticket and fly away. And the visa is not very hard to get for Turkey, right? But then COVID came. What am I supposed to do about COVID? And Turkey closed its borders and airports and the program got canceled. I was like, okay.
You know, one thing I'm so grateful for about going to the US in 2023 is we were the post-COVID babies. So everything was opening up. Like, the world was opening up and we didn't have... Like, there wasn't not so many restrictions with travel. And I'm so grateful for that because I do not know what I would have done if we had to kind of do it online. Because a few people did it online. Oh, they did the program online, but let us still got a chance to go there. So yeah, I'm still grateful that we went and enjoyed the full time there.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Well, if anyone is listening, so visa issues are different everywhere and a different program to program, but sometimes it's just, you need to be strong if you want to survive an embassy and interviews.
Yep, you have to find a podcast to rent out on. Now that's all you can do.
Oh, yes, you have to find a podcast. Oh, wow. And I wasn't very helpful because I made it sound so easy.
Yeah, and make sure that a person has problems as well.
I didn't have any problems. It just sucked.
No, that is so seamless.
It was.
Okay. Okay.
It wasn't that bad. I still think, I'm no help, to be honest. I'm no help at this point when it comes to, no, please don't listen to me. I'm no help. But then it's been great having you. I have one last question.
Same, likewise. Yep. Go ahead.
What do you look forward to?
That's a very broad question. Can you narrow it down?
It doesn't need to be narrowed down. It could just you looking forward to ending this recording and sleeping, or I'm looking forward to getting a new job and transitioning. Okay. I'm looking forward to anything. Like, literally, it's just anything you could think of.
I think I'm looking forward to my new job, right? Because it's been a couple of weeks that I've not have that job and that kind of pressure. And like, I'm currently on a goal to become the best data analyst on the planet, right? I want to know every tool, every technique that anyone on earth can use, right? To solve any problem in the world. I just want to become that. And I feel like the job is going to be my first step. Then I'm going to go for my master's. That's going to be the second step. And then it's going to take time.
I like that. I am so grateful that we got to finally do this. It's something.
Yeah.
It's been on the books. It's been shipped, but yeah, we made it.
I hope it was valuable for people as well.
I hope you had fun. Like, I had fun. I enjoyed listening to you. And I know AI was taking notes on me. Certain things I'm going back to and probably hitting you up and saying, hey, I still have questions. What do you think about it? Yeah, sure. But I'm really grateful that we got to do this. And yeah, I hope other people find it valuable and hope to catch up with you soon. And thank you so much.
Please come to Pakistan as well someday.
Well, if my friends hear you say that. So the thing is, my friend is getting married in November or December. And I'm supposed to come for the wedding.
Oh, nice. Awesome.
I'm supposed to have like a whole full Pakistan wedding. I can't wait. I'm so excited. I don't know
if you're going to enjoy that.
But yeah, she's like, it's going to be a 5-day thing. And I'm like, you guys have weddings that long?
It's longer. It's serious. It's sometimes goes on for months.
Oh my goodness. But yeah, I'm really looking forward. My friends just keep saying, come to Pakistan. And I don't need a visa, by the way. So,
see.
So I can really just jump on a plane and come.
I can't even go to Zambia without a visa.
I think you can't. I think you I don't know. We'd have to check if you can.
Yeah, let me ask Google.
I really love that.
Pakistanis citizens. Oh yes, Pakistani citizens require a visa to enter Zambia. Awesome.
I don't. Oh, that was nice.
Yeah,
I
that's
require
not nice.
A visa to come to your country.
Yeah, exactly. You should ban that.
I know. Weird. I feel like this is ending at a good note on my end. I do not know about Malta. But we should do this thing where we're checking which countries you need a visa to, and I need a
yeah,
visa.
Yeah, we should do one podcast dedicated to just visa issues.
Yes, and asking questions like, okay, but if
you, yeah, I don't can I go don't... to Japan? Can I go to South Korea though?
Yeah, I can go to Japan without a visa.
Yeah, I probably seamless for you, so you don't have to worry about it.
Oh my goodness, Lalak. This is it from us right now. Thank you so much for tuning in, and it's bye from us.
Yeah.